From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're beginning a series of conversations around the 40th anniversary this month of when the Mormon Church lifted its priesthood ban on black members. The church itself is holding what they're calling a celebration of the moment, but that celebration apparently is not going to include an apology for the past or really any difficult questions that still linger for many black Latter-day Saints. So today we're talking about what it's like to be black and Mormon today, after this.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few weeks ago, a former Mormon, a man named Jonathan Streeter, managed to concoct this hoax. He created this, well, I guess it was a website. It was a fake apology is what it was, supposedly issued by Mormon President Russell Nelson. And it offered, here's the quote here, a full unqualified apology for the error of racism that had been taught for more than 100 years by Mormon leaders. And for a while, for several hours, in fact, people thought it was real. That leaders had said they were sorry for banning black people from the Mormon priesthood and ordinances for all those years. And members of the church tweeted about it, sent Facebook posts about it, saying how touched they were by the apology, how relieved they felt about it. Now imagine how black Latter-day Saints must have felt. Certainly those who believe that while the church may have changed its policy, it hasn't yet healed the wound. The scholar and black Latter-day Saint LaShawn Williams said that she and her Mormon friends felt devastated when they learned the apology was a fake. First of all, they were furious about the hoax itself, called it manipulative and self-centered, but Williams also said it opened wounds, many wounds in the black LDS community that they figured they hadn't gotten over yet. Today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversations built around this 40th anniversary of the lifting of the priesthood ban. It was in June 6th of 1978, when Mormon church leaders announced they had received a revelation from God. We're talking about this today. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. KUER's Lee Hale is joining us first. He's our religion reporter. He's been covering all of this. And Lee, welcome. Thanks for joining us. I guess I wanted to begin, first of all, by asking how the LDS Church is talking about the anniversary itself. There's going to be this bit. We'll talk about this as we go. But there's going to be this big celebration. That's the word they're using tonight. Right. But I guess, how are they portraying it to the public? Because this is obviously a complicated history. Are they talking about it in complicated ways?
I think that word celebration says it all. That's a very purposeful word. And the B1 celebration, as in B-E-O-N-E, B1, that's happening tonight in the conference center with Gladys Knight. That's all you really need to know. If you've seen Gladys Knight perform, it's pretty incredible. Yeah. Alex Boyer, other well-known.
We should explain, for those who don't know, Gladys Knight is a Latter-day Saint.
Right. She's been Mormon since the late 90s.
Right.
But the idea is that rather than focus on the pain of the past, let's celebrate what black Mormons have done since the church's beginning. And that's really what the church would like to do is let's not reflect on the things that black Mormons couldn't do. Let's focus on what they have done. And so I think that what people will find tonight is that it's going to be this musical, visual experience saying, look at what our members have done, not just in the U.S., but around the world.
Do you have a sense? You talked with an LDS spokesperson who said that there will be a dramatic presentation. And I'm not sure what he meant by that, if there's going to be any acknowledgement of the past or some references. If there are, he said it will probably won't be long, but will there be something? Can you tell?
Yeah, I spoke with Ahmed Corbett, who works in public affairs. He's black. He's Mormon. He grew up in Philadelphia. I think he joined the church in 1980, I think 2 years right after the ban. So this is his lived experience.
Right.
And for him, I think that when he's using the word experience, it's that you it's less about the information, and it's more about, I think, the emotion of tonight. It's not so much that people going are going to learn new things. It's that they're going to kind of feel acceptance and love. Mm. And I think that's the goal, is feel like you belong as part of a, you know, unified church. I mean, I guess it's up to people attending to see if that's what they take away.
Yeah. I want to go back to this fake apology. Just lay out, if you would, what happened. A man named Jonathan Streeter, as I mentioned, he was a former Mormon. And as he's explained it, he had good intentions. He wanted to start this conversation.
It was a really disorienting thing to watch unfold online. I was at a conference, a journalism conference in California, and the church was meeting with leaders of the NAACP on a Friday morning. People were expecting a statement, and this thing started getting shared on Facebook, on Twitter. People were kind of rejoicing and saying, this shows humility, this shows, you know, some foresight from our church leadership, because this fake apology was very blunt. It was very lengthy. It was basically going, you know, line by line, saying, this is what we've said to Black Mormons. This is why it's wrong. This is what we're going to do to fix it.
Unqualified apology for the error of racism. That I'm just quoting from it here, which was taught from this office, and this is supposedly coming from, you know, the president of the church, and then to the tabernacle, you know, from the pulpit.
Right.
So it was right out there.
And it looked exactly like the Mormon Newsroom website. That's the thing that I think got a lot of people. There was a slight change in the URL, and there's maybe a few little misspellings. Other than that, it looked like, you know, official statement. But that Friday morning, people started realizing, oh, this is fake.
Yeah.
And you could just sense the pain and the frustration and the confusion, right? A lot of confusion. Why would somebody make this? Why would somebody do this? I think a lot of the outrage that the man who wrote this was that, you know, we don't want to force the church's hand. We would like them to, if they're going to say something like this, we'd like them to just say it. But I think a lot of people also maybe were surprised by how excited they were at the idea of a sincere apology like that.
What did you see from, like, just mainstream members, their reaction to it? Because I think the reaction to it is kind of telling.
Well, in my limited circles, there was people who I would consider pretty devout Orthodox Mormon who were more excited about it than I expected. Mm-hmm. And that's not a scientific sample, but I was just surprised at just the sheer amount of people who were celebrating this and excited to say, yes, this is how we operate as a church. We apologize. We try to heal. We acknowledge what happened in the past. And so not just for Black Mormons, but for white Mormons and all Mormons, I think this was really healing and powerful moment while it lasted.
I want to ask you about, in your reporting, one of the things you've learned is about the kind of the scope of this ban. We often talk about it as a priesthood ban, and it referred to just Black men. But would you say something about the scope of this? Because this, of course, involved all Black people.
Right. We often forget about Black women when we're talking about this. And all Black members were kept from the temple. The temple symbolizes heaven. You know, the Mormon church has created this symbol of heaven. You walk through the temple and you're walking to God's presence symbolically. But also, I mean, the idea is if you're temple worthy, you're ready to meet God. That's the idea.
Yeah.
And so you're telling people that despite however they live their life, for this period of time, for over 100 years, you are not prepared to meet God. You have to wait for God to work that out after you die. And you spiritually stunted is what I would say. And so the priesthood ban, yes, you know, Black men were not serving in church leadership. They were not being called on missions as a general rule. But all Black members were told that this holy of holy experiences, our goal, being sealed as a family for time and all eternity,
was off limits.
Off limits.
There's an element to the story that is important, but for those who aren't familiar with, you know, Mormon doctrine or culture, I think it can be confusing. And the question is this: from Mormon leadership's position, was this God's idea to exclude Black people from full rights of membership because, you know, whatever the reasons given, that the saints weren't ready or whatever it might be? Or was this just a racist policy by, frankly, racist leaders who were blaming God for that? I mean, it doesn't seem like that issue. That is, was this a doctrine? And in that sense, it was God's idea, or was this a policy, and that was man's idea misinterpreting God? And has that been resolved?
The word revelation is used when it comes to removing the ban. But as far as the start of the ban, that is blurry and it's confusing. And contradictory things were said during that, you know, almost 130-year period, right? Where some people said, well, this isn't really a doctrine. Some people doubled down on it. Racist ideology was taught over pulpits. I think when we talk about an apology, what people are really hungry for is just, let's clear the air here, right? The church has said that they denounce the teachings of the past, that they don't teach that anymore, that all are equal in the sight of God. But and it hasn't gone very far, as far as saying, well, the reason it was in place at all was because some of these leaders were racist, right? They haven't said that. And, you know, what I found talking to Black Mormons is they're good with nuance when it comes to following church leadership. They lived a long time walking this line of adherence, of deference, but also understanding something doesn't feel quite right because I'm being kept out. They can understand that a church leader can also be called of God and be a little misinformed and maybe a little bit racist. I think for some white Mormons, it's a harder pill to swallow. I think that what people are hungriest for is just, you know, it's the harder story is that God just somehow, you know, didn't think they deserved it. I think the simpler solution is that the leaders weren't ready for Black members.
Mormon leader Dallin Oaks, who's now in the first presidency of the LDS Church, he gave this interview a few years ago, and it was around the issue of religious liberties. But it's become, I have to say, in some ways, infamous for some. And Oaks said this. He said, "I know that the history of this church is not to seek apologies or to give them. We sometimes look back on issues and say, maybe that was counterproductive for what we wished to achieve, but we look forward, not backward." What is that about? This idea of he said, we don't give apologies. I know it's one thing to say we don't seek apologies. Yeah. Okay, that's one thing. Like, we're not looking for apologies for the way we were persecuted mercilessly in the past. But it's another thing to say we don't give them.
In this way, the church as an organization is different than a Mormon as a person. Mormons are expected to forgive and to apologize and to do these things that people aren't seeing from the organization itself. I think that the idea of moving forward is kind of where the church leaders are unified. Let's not focus on the past. The healing is in the future. And I think that there's also this idea that does the church have to give an apology? And I think most people would say, well, they don't have to. Yeah. The policy, I think a lot of people say, is good now. The policy is great as far as how Mormons treat people of all nationalities.
Yeah. So what are you worried about? Everything's fine.
It's tone.
Yeah.
And I think that when Oaks says that, I think what people hear is that we don't want to act differently. We don't want to speak differently. And I think what people are saying is the policy is good, but please just talk to us a little differently.
As you're talking to African-American Latter-day Saints, the Black Latter-day Saints, the Black Mormon community, what is it that they want? Do they want that apology? What is it that they're looking for?
I'm so impressed with the Black Mormons I interview and talk to. They're devout. They love their church leadership. I would say that they're really not asking for much of anything. They've lived their lives in the church in a time during the ban, after they've figured this out. But I think they're asking the church leaders to rise to their level in this way. If they can handle the nuance and they can balance these things, they wish the church leadership could show a little bit more flexibility, a little more understanding, a little more authenticity when it comes to things that didn't go well in the past.
This celebration going on tonight, you mentioned Gladys Knight is performing. In the past, she's been willing to speak her mind. I'm guessing she's not going to do it in this forum. Though tonight,
who knows?
Right?
I would love to see Gladys Knight riff a little bit in between
yeah,
songs.
Right.
She's eloquent and she's thoughtful, and she really does love the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's clear. She has this choir with the Saints Unified Voices. I think there's going to be a B1 choir. I don't know if it'll involve her. I think that there'll be raw emotions and raw feelings, primarily expressed through music. But I'm really excited to see what if anything she has to say tonight.
I want to go back to this conversation you had with this church spokesman, Ahmed Corbett. He told you that he thinks that this event is going to heal people, that it's supposed to be about healing. But what about that celebration is supposed to be healing if they don't at least deal with some of the hurt feelings and the baggage and the unresolved doctrines from the past?
He said, come wanting to be healed, kind of like do some work beforehand. You know, if you've got some tension, if you've got some frustration, if you're waiting for something, leave that behind and come with us as we step into the future. That's his view. That's his perspective. If you're not there yet, I don't think tonight will offer much healing. I think a lot of people will enjoy it. I think it will be powerful. I don't think it'll speak to the pain that is still there in the Mormon community, not just for Black Mormons, but for all who are still confused about what's happened.
Kay Wearsley Hale. Lee, thanks.
Thanks.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Is something missing from your morning breakfast or evening dinner prep? How about NPR's critically acclaimed sound-rich stories alongside KUER's in-depth local news? Now with smart speakers, listening just became a whole lot easier. Tell Alexa or your Google Home to play NPR, and they'll take you right to KUER's live stream. Unlock the world of public radio with just your voice by telling Alexa or Google to play NPR, and never get stuck in the driveway again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversations built around this 40th anniversary this month of when the Mormon Church lifted its priesthood ban, its ban on Black members. And the church itself is holding what they're calling this celebration of the moment at the Conference Center in Salt Lake City, music and speeches. But the celebration apparently is not going to include an apology for the past or really any difficult questions, it seems, that still linger for many Black Latter-day Saints. Many of them are still reeling from a cruel and hurtful hoax. Last month, it was a fake apology in the church's name. So today in the program, we're talking about what it's like to be Black and Mormon in 2018. LaShawn Williams is joining us. She's an assistant professor of social work at Utah Valley University, a lifelong member of the LDS Church. In fact, serves as the Sunday school teacher for adolescents. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And James Jones is with us, a musician based in Boston, also a lifelong Mormon, served a mission in South Africa, is in the Elders Quorum presidency, and has served on the stake public affairs committee for his stake there in Boston. And he's LaShawn's brother, I should also mention. James, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
LaShawn, I want to begin with you because I want to talk a little bit about the history.
Okay.
To get some sense of this, because this is something that you've talked about. So when the Mormon Church is established in 1830, we are at the height, as you've explained, of slavery, chattel slavery in the United States. And so Joseph Smith and Mormon leaders of that time, including Black members in full fellowship, like that was something. That was a big deal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Minus maybe the Quakers. There were not any other congregations that I'm aware of who openly and actively proselyted and brought in nations, kindreds, tongues, and people the way the early LDS Church did.
How do you explain that?
Well, you explain it as someone who's forward thinking. It's what you believe a prophet to be, someone who sees further than where we're currently at. And so you have Joseph Smith who says, let's bring everyone in. And then that's what ended up happening. You have to also remember context of it being founded and established in New York, in the northern part of the U.S., where you were likely to encounter more freed Black people and less enslaved Black people. Yeah. So that permits more integrated worship.
So the LDS Church was, as you've described it, really bold. And then leaders, got cold feet. They backed out. They gave in to pressure? I mean, how do you see the change? Because it happens in 20 years.
It happens within about 20 years. You, as a social worker, we always talk about the context of time and how nothing happens in a vacuum. So while Revelation was new and clear and bold, it was still happening within the context of being very different from its surroundings. And the colloquialism that we have of the LDS Church is that we live in the world, but we're not of the world. And so we were very much in the world, but not of the world, so far as our integrated worship. As that began to cost us social standing, as that began to affect the ability of and the mobility of Latter-day Saints and early Latter-day Saints to go out and teach and preach the gospel, you saw them begin to make changes and to pull back on what was happening. And I don't know in any other way to explain it besides fear. You're looking at people who are recognizing there's a cost to being inclusive. And a lot of the theories will say, well, the church didn't know that it couldn't expand, and so it had to be small and racist, apparently, in order for it to be able to survive. Mm-hmm. But you've had small non-racist churches that have survived, and the Mormon church most likely could have done the same thing. It may have just taken a different route. But fear associated with social cost and social standing, when it'll make you do some things that are out of character for your beginnings.
Yeah, the Quakers didn't change.
No, they did not. They did not. There were a number of anti-slavery and abolitionist groups who remained small and still did good work. And so you have this growing church of bold statement that it's the restored Church of Christ on earth. And so it's attempting to find its way in the reawakening and the heightened religious fervor of the time. So it's trying to find its place, and it's one of the newer ones that's there, and it's doing really cutting-edge things and is weighing its cost and balances for being able to continue in this format, particularly as it reaches out to slaveholding people in the South and then having to negotiate and navigate how do we bring in people who are enslaving others and make it a place we have to choose who's going to feel most welcome.
So, James, I want to bring you into this part of the conversation because I'm wondering if you both think, just think about it spiritually. Did the church sort of backing away from that boldness, that spiritual boldness of integrating, I mean, at the time it's crazy progressive, right? Did it cost them spiritual progress, do you think? Like, I'm wondering if you think about it in those terms, like they were headed somewhere and this really was a step backward.
I believe so, because when I think about who Jesus Christ was and what he stood for, Jesus Christ and Christianity in general, I feel like, is a faith for oppressed people. Like when you get to the time of Jesus Christ and what he was supposed to do, like what the Messiah was prophesied to do, it was to, in essence, free the captive, among many other things. So I do feel like in doing an institutionalized code switch, for lack of a better word, they definitely stunted their spiritual growth.
I agree. I think there was faith and there was fear, and where there fear and faith cannot coexist. And so there was a fear that negatively impacted the LDS church members at that time. So when you think about someone like Elijah Abel, one of our first priesthood holders and missionaries, imagine the relationships at like the micro level, person to person. Here he is ordained, called to serve, and then his friends who also hold the priesthood end up coming and telling him, okay, we need you to not preach to enslaved people. Could you kind of dial that back a bit? Just preach to free people, because if you preach to enslaved people, they might get these wild ideas about freedom that are true, but you know, we're trying to work with the people that we want to actually join the church. And like, what's that like for your friends to say, you represent what your people cannot have, and so we need you to stop preaching to them. I wonder what Brother Abel thought, because you know that you're there to liberate and that the gospel is this liberating thing, and now you can't use the philosophy of liberation to enslave people. He served three missions for the church, and I often say that's why they sent him to Canada, so that he could teach to people who were not enslaved,
right.
Because if he kept doing it in the U.S., he was going to run into these issues of, I'm teaching freedom to you, a freedom that you can't have. You know, black folk weren't allowed to read or to write, and so we got away with being able to read the Bible and to be able to have our own church meetings and church gatherings, and we sought freedom. We looked to Christ as the example of one who liberates and one who was liberated. And then yet you start having this conversation of, well, this is freedom. Here are the parts you can have. not all of it, just pieces of it. And then from your own people, from wonderful orators and preachers as Elijah Abel and Q. Walker Lewis. And then you see it and it's out of your reach and it looks just like you.
How do you see Joseph Smith in all of this? If I understand your perspective, Professor, you think that in some ways maybe he was a person of his times in terms of his views on race, but that he did in fact include black people in church services, even ordained Elijah Abel. Didn't he ordain Elijah Abel?
He's very close.
Or close to it.
Very
okay.
close in the timeline.
Certainly allowed it to happen, of course. Made his sentiments, at least from your perspective, admirable, Joseph Smith?
Yes, definitely. I think if you study the revelations and the doctrine from when Smith was on the earth, everything says preach nothing but repentance to these people. Now, what was there to repent about in the U.S. if not chattel slavery? Preach nothing but repentance and the gospel to these people, because we got plenty to repent about, which is enslaving other people. And so you're having what we call in therapy this dialectic. You're holding these two competing realities, and you're trying to do the best with what you have while you have it. And so Smith, who definitely had his issues as a man and as a person, as a leader, had his moments where he was able to shine. And all of our presidents of the church had their skill sets and had their struggles. But that's no different than any other prophet in the Old Testament, New Testament. You have these people who are called to do this work in spite of who they are. Joseph Smith was no different.
How are you explaining? So it was Brigham Young then,
1852,
institutes this ban. How do you explain Brigham Young? Just, he was a racist.
I mean, he was a New Yorker.
What does that mean?
In the East Coast Mormons were a little bit more brash in some of our approaches. One of the questions that I love to have with my fellow members is this other cultural saying that the prophet will not lead the church astray. And so I say, okay, well, then which one did it? Was it Joseph Smith who was leading us in one direction?
He was in one way.
In one
Brigham
way.
Young's the
and
other.
Brigham Young was in the other. So which one led us astray? And like you can see their minds working because they haven't really thought about that. It's usually a weaponized thing. The prophet won't lead us astray, so don't say anything negative about them. Okay, well, let's talk about these two prophets. You have these two very different ways of approaching the church and of leading the church. So now how do you hold on to that statement? I have yet to have someone really engage it all the way with me. But I think we really need to give our presidents and our leadership permission to be human. We really need to be able to say that Brigham Young is the same guy who said, I have such fear for these people that they will not question or ask for themselves, that they'll believe everything the leaders say, that they won't question and ask for themselves. So that is something that people should be doing. But there's something about fear that I think promotes and propels us to follow in under the guise of being safe and being protected. And again, time and context, you've got people who are leaving behind house and home and family to immigrate to the U.S. to come and find Zion. And a consequence of it is, well, some of us get to go and some of you can go, but you only get to have like this a third of what we get to fully experience, even though you will donate time, energy, money, supplies, and everything to the building of temples, you can't go in them. So you have these two men who lead in very different directions. And as members, how do you navigate your own personal leadership in comparison to your leaders and who they are? It's an important thing, and it's an okay thing to say, you know what, Joseph was really good at this, Brigham was really good at this, and they both were influenced and indoctrinated by the racism of white supremacy in the U.S. at that time.
What do you think, in terms of just, if you were to ask a mainstream Mormon, whose idea was this to deprive black people of the priesthood? What would the mainstream person say? Because you get that question of, was this a doctrine or was this a policy? And as I was saying to Lee earlier, if it's a doctrine, it was God's idea. God didn't think you were ready yet. If it was a policy, it was racist human leaders who were misinterpreting God's will. What do you guys think?
So if you ask a member today what they think about that, the majority of them are going to say something along the lines of what Lee said when he was on the program just now, that they don't know. And then I think the second highest number is going to be a bunch of people said it was just time, that it was God's timing. And, you know, you hear that a lot. I hear a lot that people say it was God's timing.
But that's still blaming God.
Correct. It is still blaming God, which becomes so much more problematic to say that God was the author of this racist policy. You know, that's that is a huge problem for the black saints. We hear all kinds of, at least I did when I first got ordained to the priesthood, I heard all kinds of explanations for why the ban was put in place, none of them putting the blame on the leaders of the church for their, you know, for their racism at that time. So, you know, for one thing, I'm just like, can you guys get your story straight? Like, what's the deal?
Right.
Like, why didn't we have the priesthood? And the second thing, I'm just like, I am not going to listen to you guys talk about how black people were not ready to receive the blessings of the priesthood. I'm not going to hear about any curses. I'm not going to hear about anything that suggests our innate inferiority, like something is wrong here.
What do you think?
I think we need to be connected to the scriptures we say we believe. I think when we're talking about why this happened, it obviously points to leadership. And that's not a negative thing. Peter struggled when he was told to take the gospel out into the world, where God gave him in a dream, where a sheet fell down and there were all these bugs and unclean things that were on it. And Peter, who I personally, like, he resonates with me. I think he and I are just knuckleheaded spirits, like, together in this life.
Right.
But he said, I'm not going to eat any unclean thing. And God basically says, you're going to eat whatever I tell you.
Yeah, because Peter said, because Peter was supposed to be, he thought that this was just for the Jews.
Yes.
And when he learned from Paul and from God, I guess, no, this is a message that goes to everybody.
Yes.
The Gentiles, he had a hard time with that.
He did. Yeah. He did. And so after the dream happened three different times where he was told so that he would remember what to do, he got up and he went to go and preach. Now, what happens when he goes and preaches is the person is grateful, falls to his feet and says, thank you so much for coming. Peter says, don't worship me. This is not me. This is I've been chastened by God to come and do this. So there's a responsibility that says, no, I didn't have this grand idea. I was reminded by God that this is what I'm supposed to go out and do. And our leadership, very similarly, you even have President Kimball, who was quoted as saying it was him that got in the way. He said, I believe the Negro was inferior and I was prepared to defend that to my death. He was what got in the way of seeking an answer to why we have this ban in place. And not even just Spencer Kimball, but Boyd K. Packer, who approached him and could see that this issue was weighing on him. And he said, why don't you just let it go? Just forget about it. That's like the classic white response. Well, just forget about this thing that's bothering you. Just get over it. And it's going to be okay. But Packer, in looking at Kimball, his countenance, he says, you can't let it go.
Yeah.
The Lord won't let you. And so you think about what process that must have started in Packer to say, well, if God's not going to let the prophet let go of it, what do I need to do? How do I get my house in order so that I can support the prophet? And then Kimball is able to go and pray about this revelation. And is it time? And what do we do? Because if we believe that we're a worldwide church, we're expanding in the world, but we can't expand fully because there's no access to leadership or to temple blessings and temple ordinances. So we have to just remind ourselves that we have a history of problematic human behavior in our leadership. All of our prophets and apostles in the Old and New Testament struggled with following direction the first time.
Well, not only that, and this is something you've talked about, and I think this is a very Mormon idea, Mormon theme. It's this, what's I think sometimes referred to as this pride cycle,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think like the question is, why is it that some leaders think it's not appropriate for the church, for church leaders to apologize? Just put this to rest. Like, we're sorry. Like, the fake apology was what it was, but it seemed like a pretty good idea. Come right out and just apologize. And the question is, why can't church leaders do that? And one of the things, Professor, that you've talked about is how this kind of fits into this pride cycle. That's a theme reflected over and over again in stories in the Book of Mormon, for those who aren't aware of that the more kind of wealth and power that people get, the kind of the further they get from God, or the more pride that they have, and then they become distanced from God. Does that explain some of this in some ways? Does this fit into a kind of a pride cycle? Is it a very Mormon thing, I guess?
I think it's about understanding patterns of behavior. You have patterns of behavior for many of our Christian prophets and leaders of denying and being resistant, being reminded, and then moving forward. From Moses, who said, I can't speak well, Lord, I don't want to be a leader, all the way through to Jesus, who said, if it be possible, remove this cup from me. The Mormon theology and doctrine and the stories that we have in the Book of Mormon are about people who get comfortable through their obedience and then get comfortable and complacent. and then stop doing things because they think, well, we're good now. We can just coast. Everything is fine. And then it devolves into relational disconnection, which then causes and contributes to wars and disagreements and seeking after power. I think it is also part of not having examples in American U.S. history of what an apology looks like. We are a church that our racial history follows very much parallel with the United States of America's racial history. And we learned very well how to be racist as an institution that was in a nation that enslaved people and destroyed families and communities and cultures even after enslavement was over. In the U.S., we don't have an example of apology. We don't have an example of anything minus rebellion costing you your life. So John Brown, Harper's Ferry, when you had white folk that spoke out, they were removed from the equation. So until we have more examples of accountability seeking from patriarchal white supremacy, then the church, I mean, unless it could set the example. It could set the example, which is why I think it needs to go back to being bold by setting that example. But there are other evangelical Christian preachers who are out doing it, that are calling racism America's original sin, and who are saying we really have to reckon with this if we're to really believe in redemption and healing for ourselves as a country and as Christians.
James, I want to hear you on this, because this seems like this is part of the problem, just not just within Mormonism, obviously, but in the United States itself, not being able to acknowledge privilege or racism from the past to be able to move forward. It seems like we can't really do that.
No, I totally agree, because as LaShawn already said, this is an American church at the end of the day, and our history mirrors that which we have experienced as Americans. It stands to reason that we would see the same thing in our church. So what needs to happen is, we could be the examples LaShawn said, or we just need to see more around us examples of people renouncing this history of racism, so that we can follow suit. If there is, I suppose, one good thing that came from the hoax, it was that maybe the leaders of the church saw how badly we would want something like an apology. We would want something like a simple acknowledgement that what was done in the past was wrong, and that it was not to our benefit. It was very much to our detriment, and the effects of that still affect us, still bother us to this day.
Yeah.
So I view church leadership not in a vacuum. They are entitled to their opinions. They are entitled to, how they view the world. And this kind of goes back to how we as members of the church ought to approach dealing with issues like this. When we talk about the prophets or the leadership of the church not leading us astray, I believe that the only way that the church leaders can lead us astray is if we let them. My basic interpretation of that injunction that the prophet will never lead us astray, Brigham Young also once said that if I were to get out of the way, if Joseph Smith were to lead you the wrong way, it would be because you ought to be led astray, because you deserved it. And then when explaining how we could deserve to be led astray, we get to that discourse that LaShawn quoted, where Brigham Young is basically just like, you really need to seek your own witness of the Spirit if you want to know if what we are saying is correct. I don't believe that the ban would have happened if the majority of our converts at the time weren't coming from the South, if they didn't own slaves, if the wealthiest people around at that time weren't for slavery or for the dispossession of black folk. Like, I really believe that what happened to Mormons at that time was a simple response to fear. It was a way to protect themselves, much in the same way many black people will code switch or, dial up or dial back their blackness depending on what spaces they're navigating. I believe the church did the same thing. They turned up their whiteness to navigate a space that was becoming increasingly more hostile towards them. And I believe we could have prevented that. I believe we can prevent a similar thing happening now. And I just believe that as we become more vocal and become louder about what the members of the church need, what we need for healing, what we need for progress, what we need for greater spiritual strength, I believe an apology will be on the horizon, among many other changes that will benefit the other marginalized saints.
It was so interesting the way Lee was mentioning, and this wasn't it, as he said, it wasn't a scientific sampling, but hearing from Orthodox mainstream Latter-day Saints before they realized this hoax was a hoax, And yes, it was self-centered and cruel and all of those things, but how delighted people were by the idea that their leader, and I'm talking Orthodox people, how delighted they were that leaders were humble enough to make this unadulterated apology. I mean, that was really striking. I wondered if you noticed the same thing.
I think what we noticed is this dual experience. So many of our members can say where they were, what they were doing on June 8, 1978, when the revelation was announced. My question has always been, where were you on June 7th? What was your family doing June 6th? From 1852 until June 1st, 1978, what was your family doing? Do you remember where you were, what you were doing then? Were you speaking up? Were you speaking out? Were you scared? If you were scared, just say you were scared. You know, a lot of us were coming to church and knowing that you're hearing the gospel preached, and you're knowing that only parts of it apply to you. And then you have to sit and say, brother and sister, and pray, and you have to go along with the script that we're given, because we do believe the gospel. And yet we have this power, this staying power as Black people, to understand that nuance is really important for us, and that reliance on man, especially with our experience in the U.S. and our experience throughout the world because of the transatlantic slave trade, relying on man is not going to be where we find salvation. The faith that we have in Christ and in the gospel and in the long promised day is where we really have to keep our focus, because someone can do a fake website and can make it look like this is exactly what the church could say. It demonstrates apology is possible. It demonstrates that you don't not know why these things happen. You absolutely do know why and how these things happen, because you apologize for each one of them over the course of like 7 to 9 paragraphs is what it felt like while we were reading it.
Yeah.
And yet it was a hoax to try and get a response from the church based on whatever your personal individual experiences were, at the expense of a diaspora of people who have, many of us, lost friends or family, or are often having to defend, like the non-members we sent that apology to, and then we have to walk that back.
Yeah.
And then it's like our friends, see, I told you. And it's like,
they're
yeah,
not going to apologize.
They're not going to apologize. And you fell for it. And that's hard. And walking Black people through the fact that the apology was fake was like telling them someone died every single time, because they kept, but it's the Mormon newsroom. No, it's Mormon Dash newsroom. It's not the real one. Like watching how far people fell and how much damage it did was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It was heartbreaking. And so those of us who are part of organizing the activities for this weekend made it a point to distance ourselves from focusing on the authors of the apology, but focusing on the affected.
In a statement by the Legacy Committee, the Black LDS Legacy Committee, you said that this fake apology was, I'm going to quote you here, the statement, was a performance common to many white progressives,
mm-hmm.
Particularly those affiliated with the LDS Church. What do you mean by that?
It's performative work. It's and then if we were talking about if the folks behind it were to apologize, that's performative work. They mess up and, oh, I'm sorry, and I really meant for it to be this. And we have seen it happen over and over again that they will miss the mark, and then they'll come back and apologize, and then they don't get their fake apology. Like, the fake apology was better than their real apology, because their real apology, like, misses the mark. And it's this performative allyship and this performative, where we were trying to help move conversation forward. You weren't the first ones to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. It's not like you were saying, oh, my gosh, look, racism, and the church should apologize. We live it. We don't need any help being angry about racism. We are trying to navigate a world of being Black and a world of being Mormon in two spaces where we can never really fully exist. And then hear people come to think that their gripes and their issues with what the church does or doesn't do need to be forefront at the expense of our lived, current, ongoing, present experiences.
Yeah.
It's performative work. It's not genuine. It's not authentic. It doesn't have any roots, because there's no consistency. There's no deep investment. Like, they're not sticking their necks out. The ones who have the most to risk, the ones who can say, you know what, June 7th, I don't know what my family was thinking. We still believed in the ban. really not much would have changed June 8th or June 9th. They still would have known, they still would have gone on with their lives as they were. Where are the folks who know about people who got excommunicated for ordaining black people prior to the ban being lifted? Those folks, bring them forward. Let them have a conversation. Talk to us about what that was like, because those are the examples that we needed, being willing to risk, crucify this white supremacy, lay it down at the cross, surrender, let it go, and then keep doing it every single day, over and over. Die to racism.
Are you guys tired of the question, how can you be black and Mormon? How is that possible? Why are you doing this? Don't you know the past?
Yeah, absolutely. Just, yeah. You know, it's to be expected, but it's almost like the regular questions about that we normally get about racism from other members or other white people. Like, conversations surrounding race issues are exhausting to black people in general. Like, we live this, we talk about it, the conversations are exhausting. It takes a lot of mental and emotional stamina to be able to have these conversations. I'm impressed LaShawn's even here right now. This is like her fourth interview this month.
Yeah.
And
thank you, by the way.
You're welcome.
So, yeah, like having to regularly explain yourself to people who may not even actually care about you. Like, I know for me, if I'm going to talk race or religion with somebody, you know, I want to have some kind of kinship, some kind of friendship with you, so I know that my energy spent is going to be well spent. If you're just a stranger to me, I'm not going to want to engage that conversation, because you could walk away at any moment with no expense to you, and I just wasted all this energy.
Yeah.
So
that sounds exhausting.
No, it is. It is definitely exhausting. But, you know, the conversation, it's not like it can't happen. Like, the conversations need to happen. People need to understand why we're here, but they need to do more work than simply coming to us, because us as black people, us as Mormons, us as human beings, you are not entitled to my time just because of your curiosity. This is mentally exhausting work for us, and I would just really hope that people make the effort themselves to really get to know not only our struggle as black Mormons, but get to know the struggle of Mormons, get to know the doctrine, get to know the history of the church, get to know the church itself, get to know the history of America, get to know black people. Like, do the legwork. Like, that's all I would want personally.
I wanted to ask you, Professor, one of the things that you've talked about, you talked to Lee Hale about, was how it's difficult going to church on a Sunday, and this is how you put it, holding your breath knowing that no one is going to speak to your story, knowing the grief that you carry, and that grief in that sense for wrongs in the past is almost not allowed as a conversation.
Our grief around racism,
experiencing,
surviving racism, does not come up on our Sunday meetings, but yet other people's grief we'll pray for. The biggest thing that I think stung more recently than people's website skills was when the Charleston massacre at the Mother Emanuel Church happened. There was nothing from the church, if maybe some vague statement about religious freedom, something. But yet within a week, 2 weeks, there was the terrorist attack in Paris, and the church headquarters flew the Paris flag at half mast.
That day
that it happened. And so it's hard to see that you're not seen. And you know that you can't go to church and bring your grief and lay it at the altar, because it's seen as divisive. Our experiences as black people, I mean, that's why I think a number of us have been able to navigate the nuance of figuring out how do we supplement. Because we knew if we went to black churches that there was going to be conversation. Mm-hmm. We knew that there would be a sermon, that there would be a pastor who would speak to us and who would see us and who would remind us to focus on Christ. Because that's what we needed. It wasn't really anything more than that, but just to know that someone would see us is very important. Now, I had a really good experience. It was in the summer after there was a Black Lives Matter protest and there was violence that happened in Texas. And I remember battling and not wanting to go to church at all that weekend. Mm-hmm. But when I went, I went to church and I went late and I sat through Sunday school, and then I got to the women's meeting for the third hour, and we ended up doing a talk from whatever the prophet was, Howard W. Hunter maybe, but there was a picture in the manual and it was of Christ holding a sheep, and it was talking about the 99 and the one. And it was the first time I had ever seen Christ holding a black sheep. And so Mormons can find symbolism in everything. But I was looking for no symbols. I was like, Christ is holding, it was white Jesus holding a black sheep. And it talked about going after the one. And then in a conversation later with one of our mentors, we were talking about church. And the mentor says, what do you know about sheep? And I was like, I don't know anything about sheep. What are you talking about? He says, for every 100 sheep, God will make one a different color, black, brown, spotted, something. And those colored sheep are markers for the flock. So if your colored sheep are not in, your markers are not in, your flock is not in, your flock is not safe. And so I had this really cool, symbolic, deep, amazing experience about how God purposefully creates difference and uses difference as a barometer for how connected we are. When the shepherd can look out and if he can count his five markers, he knows he has 500 sheep. If those markers are out, he has no idea how many sheep he has because they're all white. They all look the same. When your markers are not in, your flock is not in. If your flock is not in, your flock is not safe. And so being seen like that was purposeful. And that was God. My leaders took the lesson in a totally different way in Relief Society. They're, you know, kids leaving the church and folks, you know, wandering and falling away. I was like, no, this is Jesus talking to black people because this is a black sheep and this is the marker and this is the safety measure. And so all of us who are experience marginalization based on our identities, we are the marker for the flock. And it's important that people understand that if the marker is feeling grieved because the marker was kicked out of the flock, that's important. And then that means we all have to leave the 99 and go after the one.
LaShawn Williams, she teaches social work at Utah Valley University. Thank you
very much
for being with us. And James Jones, a musician based in Boston. I guess you're here for the conference this weekend.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Which the conference is called The Legacy of Black Pioneers this Saturday in Sandy. Good luck, both of you, on
that.
And we'll have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We should also mention the LDS Church's B1 commemoration is being streamed live tonight at 7:30. You can get information about that also on our website. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover directed the show, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.